Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Welcome to the oral argument in Lee versus Warden, capital case. The division of time is 30 minutes to the side, and we will hear from Ms. Witter first for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, this is Marcia Witter on behalf of Appellant James Lee. Trial counsel failed to investigate numerous red flags of the horrifying neglect and abuse their 19-year-old client had suffered virtually his whole life. As a result, jurors in Mr. Lee's case never heard, for instance, that as an infant, his family used 2x4s to turn his crib into a cage so that his drugged-out caretakers would not have to look after him. Nor did jurors learn that even as a toddler, his mother routinely assaulted him, on one occasion striking him so hard he flew into the air and crashed on the floor bleeding, or that while still in diapers, he could often be found playing in the road in the middle of the night, or that he often talked to his kindergarten teacher, about killing himself. Jurors never learned that Jamie Lee was so starved for human interaction that he learned how to behave from the dog living under the porch. Like the dog, he would bark, scratch his ears, and chase after cars, behavior numerous state habeas witnesses characterized as bizarre and disturbing rather than mere child's play. Jurors never heard evidence painting the heart-wrenching image of Jamie as a filthy child with rotting teeth, tattered clothes, and a head full of lice, begging for food from neighbors to feed himself and the worms in his belly. Jurors did not learn of these and many other horrifying details of Mr. Lee's young life. Instead, counsel presented a misleadingly benign defense centered around Mr. Lee's hyperactivity, his father's abandonment, and his welfare mother's inadequate best efforts to raise him, an image wholly divorced from the reality of Mr. Lee's life of misery. The state habeas court, after hearing the live testimony of trial counsel and considering a wealth of mitigating evidence, held that trial counsel were ineffective in their investigation and presentation of mitigation. The Georgia Supreme Court, in reversing that ruling, made numerous unreasonable errors of fact and law, and its decision deserves no deference from the court. I'd like to move into discussing deficient performance. In our briefs, we had argued that it was possible
Ms.
that
Witter,
the court under Wilson.
Ms. Witter, before you get to that, I must have missed something because both your brief and the red brief discussed deficient performance, but the COA was granted limited to the issue of whether the determination of the Georgia Supreme Court that Lee was not prejudiced by any deficiency involved an unreasonable application. The whole point of a COA is to limit and focus the issues that will be decided on appeal. Help me out on that. If the COA is limited to a prejudice determination and whether that was reasonable, why did the parties get to just brief the deficiency determination?
Well, I think that the reason the deficiency determination has been addressed by both parties is that it's not clear what the court should do with the fact that the Georgia Supreme Court did not address deficient performance.
Well, then we could have granted the COA or the district court granted the one here, and we didn't expand it. On that issue, what should the court do with the fact that the Georgia Supreme Court didn't address deficiency? I don't understand how, when the court says this is what we want argued, or the district court has said that, and we've refused to expand it, the party just expanded on their own in their briefs. I'm not criticizing you.
I construed the district court's grant of a COA to be one that basically was on what is the question, whether counsel were ineffective in their investigation and presentation of mitigating evidence.
And Judge Wood just didn't know how to say that?
She didn't address the issue, but this court's decision in Knight, I think, makes it an issue. I'm happy if the court wants to defer to the state habeas court's reasoned ruling finding that there was deficient performance. But if that's not the case, then deficient performance is part of the inquiry.
Ms. Witter, you don't understand. What I would be happy with, and I don't mean to sound harsh in this, is if the attorneys followed the guidance and direction. It's not just guidance, it's direction that was provided by the Certificates of Appealability. And the COA frames the issue. And we've struck briefs before for going beyond the COA. The way, if you don't think the COA was phrased correctly or is broad enough, the way to remedy that is to file a motion to expand the COA, which you did, although you didn't ask for it to be expanded in this particular. And then when the court denies it, the court has denied it. Or when the court's granted it, the court's granted it. I, for one, am extremely reluctant to address an issue that a COA was not granted on. We find, for example, that assuming there was deficiency, that there was prejudice, and that the district court, that even with deeper deference, there was prejudice, and the district court was wrong on that. What we could do then is we could have asked for supplemental briefing, and then, or we could have remanded to the district court and had the district court take the first cut at that. That's the proper procedure. I haven't discussed this with my two colleagues, so I'll let you go on that if you want to. I'm just procedurally concerned about that, because if this embraces deficiency, then any COA is just kind of discretionary advice to the attorneys.
If I may respond, Your Honor, I apologize for misconstruing the scope of the COA, but because the district court, in fact, stated in granting the COA that because the state habeas court had granted sentencing relief based on finding both deficient performance and prejudice, that it was granting a COA on that issue, even though the wording of the COA itself is narrower than that, I construed the grant to be broader, and I apologize for not being as particular about the court's language as I should have been. I believe that the court has power to expand the COA at this point to address issues that both parties have fully addressed.
Yeah, there's no question about that. My concern was that attorneys just ignore the COA rather than ask us to, misinterpret the COA rather than ask us to expand it. But I don't want to take any more of your time on that.
In any event, if I can move on, it appears from the Knight decision, as reflected in the 28J letter that I filed, I believe, on Friday, that there's no longer a question of whether we defer to the state habeas court's ruling on deficiency or whether this court addresses the issue de novo. So I believe that, assuming the court does expand the COA to address the deficiency prong rather than remanding it or asking for additional briefing on it, that this court needs to address that issue de novo. In this case, counsel were deficient in their investigation and presentation of mitigation, as the state habeas court found. After obtaining school records and records from the Boys Ranch that Mr. Lee attended for 2 years as a teenager, counsel performed very little work to develop mitigation, even though they knew that a sentencing phase was likely. Counsel's billing records reflect that they pretty much, after hiring Dr. Grant, did little until the eve of trial and started doing some work in the month of May when trial was imminent.
Counsel, this is Judge Newsom. Can I maybe offer you a little bit of help? But in light of Chief Judge Karn's question, I think your time might be better spent in fast-forwarding in your outline to your prejudice argument, and maybe starting there, and to the extent you have time, doubling back to talk about deficiency. But if I were you, I would start talking about prejudice.
Okay, I'm happy to do that, Your Honor. Had jurors heard the sad and sordid story of Mr. Lee's troubled life, there is more than a reasonable likelihood that at least one juror would have voted for a sentence less than death. No deference should be given to the Georgia Supreme Court's determination of no prejudice. The court made numerous unreasonable errors in assessing that prong of Strickland. The court unreasonably discounted the mitigating evidence pretty much in its entirety. They did not consider the affidavit evidence from family, friends, neighbors, and others, including teachers, on the clearly erroneous ground that much of it had been ruled inadmissible by the state habeas court, when in fact, as reflected in a chart that was submitted in the district court and referenced in the brief, very little was excluded, and respondent identified only one snippet of excluded testimony that the state habeas court in fact relied on, that regarded Barbara, Mr. Lee's mother's reputation for sleeping around in exchange for drugs, for which there was plenty of other admissible evidence. The court also didn't consider the expert testimony. In state habeas proceedings, Dr. Grant, who had testified at trial, testified that on the basis of the new evidence he'd been given, he would have diagnosed Mr. Lee with PTSD rather than simply hyperactivity, ADHD. The court also didn't consider Dr. Boyer's evidence on the ground that she herself had not diagnosed PTSD. As she explained in her affidavit, she didn't diagnose PTSD because she didn't evaluate Mr. Lee close in time to the crimes, but she felt that based on all the evidence she had reviewed, which was significant, that Dr. Grant's diagnosis of PTSD was reliable and accurate.
All right, so this is Judge Newsom again. Let me ask you a quick question. Why doesn't this case fall within the line of cases that we've had before where we've said that where the newly discovered evidence, we'll call it, doesn't sort of bring to bear entirely new mitigating circumstances or, sort of bring in any brand new facts, but instead sort of fleshes out an existing factual predicate? I mean, isn't that what we have here? It's not as if the defense counsel at sentencing did nothing. They interviewed a bunch of people and developed some facts and put on six witnesses and told a story. And admittedly, the story that is being told on post-conviction is grittier and more tragic, but is it fundamentally a different story, or is it fundamentally the same story told in greater detail? And if it's the latter, haven't we said before that that's just sort of not the kind of thing that gets you relief in habeas?
Well, Your Honor, it is true that this court has said many times that the latter version of events is not the kind of situation that gets relief in habeas. But unlike, and respondents attempted to paint this case as being a run-of-the-mill case, but it's not. The jury heard nothing about any of the abuse or neglect that Mr. Lee suffered. This isn't a story about a single mother doing her best on a welfare check with a child with ADHD, which is the story that the jurors heard. This is a story about a child who from day one suffered such extreme neglect that he learned how to behave from his dog, and he had to beg neighbors for food for himself and his worms. Excuse me. Getting a little emotional. He had to beg for food from neighbors, and when he was not being neglected, he was at the receiving end of blows and horrific, debasing insults from the person who was supposed to be loving him the most, his mother.
I just want to make sure that I've got it straight, though. Didn't Grant testify at sentencing? There was a lot of abuse. I mean, I think you're right that the post-conviction evidence is a lot more detailed. I give you tragic. But wasn't the sentencing jury told that there was abuse?
But they weren't told any evidence of abuse. They just had somebody mention the word without any actual supporting facts. He didn't explain what he meant by that. He didn't explain what he had been told that led him to believe that there was any abuse. He mentioned the word abuse twice and the word neglect once, and that doesn't constitute evidence. This court in other contexts have said that conclusory assertions by an expert without underlying facts to support them doesn't constitute meaningful evidence. And in the case here, the jury heard nothing to substantiate any conclusory assertion by Dr. Grant that Mr. Lee suffered some abuse. And the abuse, by the way, wasn't by his mother. It was couched in the context of his grandparents. The jury just didn't get any evidence to explain what those words meant, and those words didn't mean anything.
Is your argument that that additional evidence was on top of conclusory statements, or that it was a more detailed presentation of the evidence that the original jury heard?
The jury heard no evidence of abuse or neglect. They didn't hear any explanation from any witness, either Dr. Grant or any of the family members who testified that Mr. Lee had been subjected to neglect or abuse. And counsel's closing argument told them no more than that. They pitched his mother as being a 19-year-old welfare mom who did the best that she could, even though she didn't provide maybe the nurture and care that most children need. That's a benign version of what happened to Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee was subjected not just to passive neglect, but to active, violent rage and torment. And the jurors heard nothing of it. And trial counsel said that if they'd known about this stuff, Mr. Adams said he didn't actually know of any abuse. If he'd known about it, then he would have presented it. I know that the Georgia Supreme Court found otherwise, but if you review his testimony in habeas, he stated, and I quote, "I was aware of what would be called neglect, I would think. Physical abuse? I can't say whether I was or I wasn't. I really can't recall that." Later he said, "Had we known that she physically abused him, I think we certainly would have presented that. You know, physical abuse, like beating him up or cutting him or something like that." And he later, Mr. Adams said, he would have presented testimony like Dr. Boyer's affidavit, where she goes into great detail about the neglect and abuse Mr. Lee suffered, how that impacted his development, and how that was connected to the crime.
What about, this is Judge Newsom, what about the fact, though, that didn't the Georgia Supreme Court say that Adams and Brooks had asked Lee about abuse and that he had said that there were isolated incidents but nothing more? And haven't we said that it's hard for counsel to sort of know what they can't know when they ask their client and they're sort of not told the truth?
Well, actually, Mr. Lee told them a lot about his background, and they weren't very interested in it. The little bits that in their notes that they jotted down weren't followed up, apparently, with any questions about it. But counsel also, the Georgia Supreme Court, misspoke when it said that Mr. Lee only told them that there were isolated amounts of abuse. What counsel actually said was that he told us about some isolated incidents, but we weren't aware that it was a pattern. Well, the reason they weren't aware it was a pattern is because they didn't investigate it. The little bit of investigation they made was of the mother and the stepfather, the people who had a vested interest in not disclosing the abuse and neglect that Mr. Lee had suffered. In Johnson, the same thing happened. Counsel talked to the dad, who they knew was they'd been told was an alcoholic and abusive. And when the dad said, "No, not really," they left it at that. And the court found that that was ineffective.
I'm sympathetic to your case being pretty similar to Wiggins, but of course, in Wiggins, the court was looking at the issue de novo rather than with the appropriate standard of deference to the state Supreme Court. How we should look at the Wiggins case compared to this one, given the different standards of review at play?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that this court needs to address it de novo as well, because the court relied on unreasonably wrong factual findings and unreasonably wrong analysis. In Williams versus Taylor, for instance, where I believe both prejudice and deficient performance were addressed by the state courts, those findings were not reviewed deferentially. They were reviewed de novo based on the unreasonable application of law that the court found. One application of which is appropriate here. In Williams, the court found that the state Supreme Court had improperly failed to consider the aggregate of evidence presented both in state habeas and at trial in order to assess prejudice, and the Georgia Supreme Court did the same thing here. In addition, as in Porter, the court discounted to irrelevance the state habeas evidence, even though that evidence was powerful and moving. And this is pretty close to Wiggins, except for in Wiggins, the defendant was 27 years old, whereas in this case, Mr. Lee was only 19. As the Supreme Court has explained as far back as Eddings versus Oklahoma, the type of evidence that was presented in state habeas is powerful evidence when you're dealing with a young defendant. Let me quote from Eddings. "Evidence of a difficult family history and of emotional disturbance is typically introduced by defendants in mitigation. When the defendant was 16 years old at the time of the offense, whereas here 19, there can be no doubt that evidence of a turbulent family history, of beatings by a harsh father, and of severe emotional disturbance is particularly relevant." So, And the jury in this case, as the jury in DeBruce, as in DeBruce, the jury was given an inaccurate picture of what Mr. Lee's life was like. Johnny Lee testified, that's his father, testified at trial that he and Barbara never fought in front of Jamie Lee. Had counsel investigated, they would have learned that his parents had vicious fights in front of their son. Barbara testified that there was always enough food for Jamie and that she did the best she could on the $160 a month she received from welfare. Had counsel investigated, they would have learned that Jamie was forced to beg for food from neighbors, for himself and his worms, and with rotting teeth, tattered clothing, and a head full of lice.
Ms. Witter,
Barbara testified, yes.
Before you run out of time, let me ask you more of a pure legal question. Knight looked at the prejudice determination or issue de novo because the Florida Supreme Court didn't reach it. But as I understand, you're not asking us to look at deficiency de novo. You're asking us to defer to the state trial court's determination that there was deficiency. Is that your position?
Well, our position in the briefs, Your Honor, was that it was an open question, but that under Wilson, that the court should look through the Georgia Supreme Court's non-finding on deficiency to the reasoned decision of the state habeas court. But
okay.
At the beginning of this month...
Yes. I was getting to that.
Court.
But I was also going to ask you if there was any textual support for your position in the AEDPA. Which refers to the habeas petition shall not be granted in 2254D unless there's an unreasonable determination. It doesn't say shall not be denied. But I understand you've, at least for now, subject, I guess, to you can file a petition rehearing en banc, you've conceded that we don't owe deference if we reach deficiency. We don't owe deference to the state collateral court's determination on the law as applied to the facts on deficiency, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, although Knight also makes clear that the federal court should defer to the state habeas court's fact-finding to the extent that that's supported by the record. And in this case, the state habeas court's fact-finding is supported by the record. I'm not sure what my time is, but let me check.
Courtroom deputy, do we have time reading for Ms. Witter?
She has 43 seconds, and then she has two extra minutes.
So that I don't lose my 43 seconds, unless you would like to give them to me in rebuttal, I am happy to address some more questions about deficient performance. The state habeas court may
ask you one thing on the prejudice question. Are there any factual determinations that you think that the Georgia Supreme Court made that were clearly erroneous?
I think that the primary errors that the court made were legal, and that it discounted the evidence pretty much in its entirety. But I also believe that when the court made the determination that Mr. Lee's evidence was simply not bad enough because of picky distinctions between Mr. Lee's case and Mr. Wiggins' case, I'm not sure if that's a factual finding or a legal conclusion, but it's clearly.
I guess that's what I'm asking is are you asking us to find if there are any factual conclusions clearly erroneous, or are you relying only on an unreasonable application of the law?
I think that concluding that Mr. Lee's life history was not adequately mitigating, that he was only slapped a couple of times, which is what the court finds, is not supported by the record and is clearly erroneous. If you read affidavits, Mr. Lee suffered a life of misery with very few glimpses of sunlight in his life. And for the Supreme Court to diminish the force of that evidence is, to me, rather appalling and unreasonable under AEDPA. I think that I probably should reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, we'll give you four.
I'm probably out.
We'll give you your full 5 minutes in reply, Ms. Witter, and we'll hear now from Ms. Graham.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Sabrina Graham for the Attorney General's office on behalf of the respondent. Can you hear me? Am I loud enough? I'm sorry.
I can hear you.
Yes.
Thank you. I would like to first address, obviously, what Judge Carnes said in the beginning regarding the COA. Looking at the COA here, all I can say is I think I absolutely misinterpreted that to include both prongs, but reading it several times, I think it is only speaking to prejudice, and I actually only decided to address prejudice today. The reason that deficiency was addressed in our brief was because the other side addressed deficiency, but if there is no COA on it, then respondent should have said that that's not before the court. I agree with Judge Carnes on that. And I certainly think the stronger argument here today is that the Georgia Supreme Court did not unreasonably determine prejudice in this particular case. If the court doesn't have any other questions on that, I'm happy to briefly address the Knight issue.
Use your argument time the way you wish if there are no questions to guide you.
All right. Okay. So regarding Knight, this is the way that I understand this court looks at ineffective assistance when you have a lower state court opinion and then a reasoned higher state court opinion. It's my understanding that the Georgia Supreme Court in this particular case did not determine deficiency. They only determined prejudice. Therefore, if you were to look back through to the state habeas court's decision, there is a deficiency determination there. And, however, in this particular case, the Georgia Supreme Court determined that the state habeas court used the wrong standard in determining deficiency. Therefore, if the court is to look at deficiency, I think it would be under de novo review. Regarding any fact findings in the state habeas court's order, the way I read Knight was that Knight talked about, and I could be wrong about this, talked about the credibility determinations of the state habeas court, in part because the state habeas court, the lower court, had seen those witnesses live and can make the, determinations based upon demeanor and things of that nature. However, here, when I read the state habeas court's order, I don't necessarily see it as the court making credibility determinations that trial counsel wasn't telling the truth and that all of the affiants were telling the truth. It just seemed that the state habeas court was stating that although trial counsel did something, they didn't do enough under the erroneous standard that the state habeas court applied. That's my understanding of Knight and this court's precedent and 2254.
Well, so I guess as the party principally responsible for Knight, for better or worse, this is Judge Newsom. As my recollection of Knight with respect to the state habeas court's fact findings is that we said something to the effect of, the Florida Supreme Court had deferred to those fact findings and credibility determinations, and we had no reason not to do the same thing. So those credibility determinations had been sort of filtered through the state Supreme Court, if you will. So it wasn't a look-through. It was just that the state courts, plural, had made the credibility determinations and or deferred to those credibility determinations, and there was no basis for us to turn our back on them.
I absolutely agree, Judge Newsom. Look-through is the wrong term. I should not have used that term. Yes, I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. And in this particular case, I don't know what fact findings are left after the Georgia Supreme Court has determined that the court decided that particular prong erroneously. When I say I don't know what facts are left, I don't know what fact findings are left a petitioner is necessarily relying upon that the Georgia Supreme Court should have relied upon. I think that's the better way to put that. Going on to the prejudice, and I stand by, I do think this is a sort of a run-of-the-mill case. A lot of respondents' brief was centered around laying out what the other side of the record was. I'd like to put it that way. It wasn't just to address deficiency, but it was also to inform on prejudice, because in this particular case, you had trial counsel who had gathered almost all of his background records. It's questionable as to whether or not they got the Charleston County records, but they gathered all of his background records, and this was Lee was a person who had been seen by mental health professionals since he was 2 years old. He was in special education classes for the severely emotionally disturbed. He was at a boys' ranch as a teenager, and social workers were constantly involved, it seems, in the school. He was in a classroom with only six people for his SED classes, that is, not for the regular classroom. The teachers went to his home, and when he was in the boys' ranch, the social workers went to their home once a month. The parents went to counseling. And nowhere in any of this does it state that Mr. Lee was physically abused or deprived of clothes or deprived of food. There's nowhere in there. And the Georgia Supreme Court does make a point of saying that, you know, there's no other records here showing that. So I think it's important to point that out, because I think the district attorney would have pointed that out when he argued the case in sentencing, that although you have all these people up here saying that he was exposed to all of this horrific abuse, but at the same time, not a single one of those people, to include teachers and administrators, ever did anything. That it just seems slightly incredible. And I'd like to speak to the issue of just briefly about the worm.
So are you saying that the testimony in the affidavits is unlikely to be true, or that it wouldn't have mattered anyway?
I'm not saying that it would not have mattered. What I'm saying is that the credibility of it could be questioned by the district attorney at trial, given that all of the school records and the fact that this kid had been so closely monitored his life throughout the system and that wasn't there. That's certainly something I would bring up if I were the district attorney, that it seems incredible that nobody ever told anybody that he was being abused in this manner, despite the fact that he's in a class with only six other kids, and they're saying that he's walking around with bruises on a daily basis and, you know, ratty clothes and lice and all this, but yet that's not in the records. It does say that he had a bad case of dental caries when he was young, but later on it says that, you know, his teeth were fine, and it does say at one point he was sloppily dressed, but then in another interview at school it said he was well-groomed. So it's, you know, I think there is conflicting information there. I'm not saying that all of the affiants weren't telling the truth or anything like that, simply that there are credibility issues there. And trial counsel...
Did you argue in your brief that there were credibility issues rather than that, even assuming the credibility of these witnesses, it wouldn't have made a difference?
No, I did not. I did not make that argument, no. I don't think so. I was just pointing that out here. Going back to the prejudice argument, I do think this case is a lot like Holsey versus Warden, in that the jury, I know it's, you take a record and they say, oh, well, there's only this many pages in the record from the sentencing phase, but there's so much more that goes on at trial than that. You see in this actual transcript, you see the witnesses crying. You see his biological father up there, and the man can't even say what the birthdays are for any of his children. He can't say one nice thing about James Allison Lee. So it's about more than just did somebody get on the stand and say he was slapped and beaten and abused. It's also about the things that are shown through their demeanor and also in the way that they present themselves. And in this particular case, the jury was told that he behaved like a dog and he didn't speak until he was 6 years old. They were told that his mother was poor. I mean, his mother said she only got $160 a month. She specifically told the jury that. Nobody's going to think that you can feed someone very well on $160 a month. They were told that he was in severely emotionally disturbed classes throughout most of school. They were told that he had to go to a boys' ranch when he was a teenager because of his that he got into trouble and that he was failing all of his grades. I mean, the jury knew he had a dysfunctional childhood. There's no way they could have stepped away from that and not have seen that there was a dysfunctional childhood there. And I think it is absolutely the same story that is being told in state habeas, just in more detail. And under this court's precedent,
do you see it as a qualitative difference or a quantitative difference between a rough childhood where the mom did the best she could and a pretty dystopic existence of, you know, asking for food to feed the worms in your belly? Is that an issue of more detail, or is that a totally different kind of qualitative situation that the jury would have had to consider?
You know, when I was looking at Cullen versus Penholster, it seems like to me it's like that, where they said there was a little bit of abuse, and then they came along in state habeas and they said, no, there was belts and whips and paddles and things of that nature. So I don't know about qualitative or quantitative. I just think that when you're being told essentially the same story, that someone has a difficult, dysfunctional childhood, and, you know, he did not kill his mother or his father. He killed this other person over here who wasn't related to him, who had nothing to do with this abuse. I think that it's still the same story being told in state habeas. It's just more detail. I mean, I guess then it would be quantitative if I had to put something on it. Did that answer your question, Elle? I apologize.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Going back to what the Georgia Supreme Court did, because that's what this is about. This isn't, you know, just about prejudice. This is about what the Georgia Supreme Court did. I don't see anywhere in their opinion here where they're discounting to irrelevance any of the evidence. I think that it's always mindful that the Georgia Supreme Court was responding, in fact, to some of Mr. Lee's arguments. And one of the arguments regarding the mental health evidence, post-traumatic stress disorder, was that it, you know, the court said there wasn't this nexus between it. But what I think they were specifically responding to was that Dr. Boyer and Dr. Grant said, well, his PTSD can explain his crime. But when you read their testimony, when you read the affidavits, it doesn't do much to explain the crime. If he certainly, you know, impulse disorder and aggressive and anger, all things which are indicative also with ADHD, were presented to the jury and which are also part of PTSD, but you don't have a disassociative state, and you don't have someone who didn't know what he was doing, and these crimes took place over several hours. I mean, first he went to a gun shop and he robbed the gun store and he got a weapon, and then he spent a couple of hours luring Miss Chauncey out of her home in the middle of the night, and then when she arrived with the truck, he shot her, and then after he shot her two more times and he dumped her body and he left her in her underwear. He didn't even have the decency to put the gown over her or anything. And then as he goes on, he coldly tells his friends what he's done, and he escapes from prison. I just, you know.
Ms. Graham.
Yes.
I couldn't find in the briefs or in the state court opinions how much time elapsed between the time he shot the Miss Chauncey in the face and the time he fired the shots that killed him.
It was roughly a little bit over an hour, I believe, from the way they... He shot her in the one place, and then they stopped, and they got gas, and he drove out to the middle of the woods. It was a little over an hour.
Okay.
Going back to the Georgia Supreme Court's opinion, again, I don't think they discounted any of their evidence. They simply looked at it, and they just did not think that weighed the aggravating evidence. Regarding the statement that they didn't consider the mental health expert's testimony, they clearly did consider the mental health expert's testimony, but as the district court said, they just didn't give it the weight that petitioner thought they should give it. Regarding the affidavits where the Georgia Supreme Court says that a lot of it was ruled inadmissible, well, that was a 35-page order, and there were many things that the court granted the respondents objections to on hearsay. However, I did not read the Georgia Supreme Court as stating they were ignoring everything that they thought had been excluded. It seemed more like they were pointing out there were some problems with the state habeas court's order, that at one point it said something was inadmissible, but then later on it seemed to rely upon it. But still, I don't see anywhere in there where they said, we're not considering this evidence, or they did not look at that evidence. I don't see anything like that in their opinion. They clearly looked at all of it, and they weighed it out, and they didn't feel like it weighed in his favor. And I, under AEDPA, I don't think you can say that no reasonable, you know, jurist would have done what they did. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm happy to talk about anything else. Like I feel like this all really does boil down to prejudice and how you weigh it, and whether or not the Georgia Supreme Court did a reasonable job. And I don't see how they did not do a reasonable job in this particular case.
I don't hear any other questions, Ms. Graham. Thank you, and we'll give Ms. Witter her 5 minutes and hear from her.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to point out that in Knight, Judge Newsom, you wrote that, like the Florida Supreme Court, we must defer to the state post-conviction credibility determinations because federal courts don't have a license to redetermine them, and that because those determinations, I believe, referring to the state habeas court's determinations, are supported by competent and substantial evidence, we defer to the state court's decisions. It's true that the state habeas court in Mr. Lee's case didn't make credibility determinations about the essentially unrebutted evidence of Mr. Lee's abuse, but it did make credibility determinations about trial counsel who testified live in front of the court and concluded that counsel's explanations for why they didn't investigate certain things were either post hoc explanations or simply unreasonable because counsel had curtailed their investigation too soon. Counsel for respondent suggested that there's nothing in the records that counsel obtained or had access to that would have indicated that there were problems in Mr. Lee's life, but that's simply not true. There were three sources of red flags that they had access to: the 1980 intake summary and psychoeducational evaluation conducted in kindergarten, Mr. Lee's own statements to counsel, and the state's mental health evaluation, which expressly suggested that, quote, independent verification of Mr. Lee's reports of abuse would offer mitigating evidence at sentencing. There are plenty of red flags in those documents. His mom described herself to the kindergarten investigator as the town drunk and clown, and said that she was turning into an alcoholic. She said she had to padlock her young son's bedroom so that he would not wander into the road and hurt himself, that he began acting like a dog because he didn't have any friends and would bark and chase cars. Now, there was a mention at trial that he barked like a dog, but kids bark like dogs. That doesn't have any meaning unless you understand that his behavior was, in fact, him acting like a dog because he didn't know how to act otherwise. The reports also said he would go into trances and rock himself, and his kindergarten teacher reported that he was very angry with his father, this is at the age of 6, for abandoning him, something that he clearly must have heard from his mother, despite her protest that she didn't badmouth his father to him. Mr. Lee also told his attorneys things. He told them that he got as far as 9th grade and that he went to the boys' ranch because of, quote, family problems, and he explained that his mother had a drug problem and they didn't get along because of, quote, so many things she did. Counsel didn't explore with us so many things were. He recalled a time when his mom was passed out all the time, and recalled an instance when his father smacked his mother in the face, even though he was really young at the time. He also gave the names of numerous potential witnesses, including teachers, family members, friends, and employers, who counsel never spoke to. These included Leo Pravat, a cousin that he called
Counsel, you have
Leo.
2 minutes.
Thank you, David. And the mental health evaluation conducted by the state said that independent verification of these experiences would be valuable as far as documentation of childhood trauma and the effect which this can have on subsequent emotional development, important information for mitigation. Counsel did nothing with that other than to mention on their way back from the actual evaluation that they had seen that Mr. Lee had been evaluated. It's also not true that the Georgia Supreme Court gave meaningful consideration to the mitigation that was presented in state habeas. Contrary to what respondent's attorney has said, the court mentioned the evidence, but it didn't give it any meaningful consideration. I believe in Porter, the state Supreme Court had also mentioned the evidence. They explained what was presented, and then they didn't give it any weight. The same thing happened here. And any question about credibility of the witnesses in this case should be rejected, because the fascinating and important thing about this case is that there's consistency of narratives from a wide array of sources, including documentation and numerous witnesses who are both neighbors and teachers. One of his teachers in sixth grade reported that Mr. Lee had shown up at school with bruises and welts all over his body and face. Counsel, had they investigated, would have been aware of that. I probably am running out of time, so if I can wrap up with the court's permission.
Yes.
The first 19 years of Mr. Lee's life was full of abuse and privation, but his jury was told virtually nothing about the misery he suffered pretty much from birth. Had they learned of just some of the horrifying facts of his background, there's a reasonable likelihood that at least one juror would have voted for a sentence less than death. The Georgia Supreme Court's contrary conclusion was unreasonable for the many reasons we have outlined today and in the briefs. This is truly the rare case where a state court's determination that counsel was adequate is so wrong that it warrants federal intervention, and we respectfully ask the court to grant the writ.
Thank you, counsel. Both sides did a good job on that argument. We appreciate it, and we'll take that case under submission and stand in adjournment.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stay safe, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Bye.